everybody. I'm Kevin Winder, and thanks for tuning in to another podcast of Beyond Everything Radio. Like always, I have a question for you. What's the real problem with lust and adultery? Our world is saturated with sexual content. Lust and adultery are constant topics in all forms of modern entertainment. And fewer people seem to be able to discern the line of sexual immorality. Some even reject the notion altogether. In today's podcast and post, we take a closer look at lust and adultery. While most of the world thinks the problem is cheating or lying, we discover today that the problem is something far more common. Join me now as we see beyond our failed morality codes and discover the true meaning of the commandment against adultery. Hello, everybody. Thanks so much for coming back to another episode of Beyond Everything Radio. I am your host. My name is Kevin Winder. I like to serve the world as an online pastor, author, and uncoach, among many other things that I do, just like you. Welcome to the program. Welcome all you new folks who are tuning in, who are subscribing. I want to say thank you for doing that. And thank you to all of you folks who have been on for a while now. This podcast is gone over 3 years, coming up on 4 years of podcasts. And I want to say thank you to all of you, many of which who have been with me from the beginning. I trust that this content is engaging your mind. It is asking you to look deeper. It's bringing about, bubbling to the surface, bigger questions. That's what I want to do. That's what I am here to do. These questions are part of your own existential journey. They're a part of your own spiritual development. They're a part of your path to self-discovery. And I'm so glad to be a part of that. Thank you for including me, letting me be a little nugget, a little voice in the back of your head. And hopefully, as you listen to this stuff, it sticks with you through the week, just kind of prodding in the back of your thinking. That's how I know it's working. And that's how I know it's a good thing. So folks, welcome to another podcast. We are at podcast number 192. And today we're going to talk about adultery and dismemberment. That's right, podcast number 192, adultery and dismemberment. So if you've been tuning in for the last several weeks, folks, we've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount. And we've been breaking it down into little pieces, as most teachings do. But as you can see, I'm not teaching this in the typical way. You are not going to see the typical content that is taught by a pastor within a church or a Bible teacher within some institutional structure. I'm a freelance. I am unattached. I'm unaffiliated. I can teach this from its most pure perspective because I do not have to drive the content into some kind of behavior modification program for you. I don't have to enlist you into some institutional game here. This is simply reveal what is being said. I do that with the hard work of biblical hermeneutics or the science of interpretation. I take it seriously. I do all the hard work. I read the original languages. I study all the context. And then something emerges, and I tell it to you through a story. And today is no different. And today's subject is going to really kind of get at the heart of a lot of folks. Now, the subject adultery may be near and dear to you. Maybe you are someone who has suffered from this. It's happened to you. It's broke up your family. Maybe you are someone who has done this to your family or to others, and you feel horrible. And maybe you are someone who has done this and has tried not to feel it, tried to hide from the pain that it caused. And maybe you're not even an adulterer. Maybe lust is really more your thing. Maybe you're more of a voyeur. Maybe you're more stuck into pornography. If you're stuck into, you just can't turn your eyes from looking at all the babes or the guys or whatever it is. Maybe sexual attraction and sexuality has a stronger gravitational pull in your life. This is a reality for a lot of folks. And over the years, I've counseled a lot of folks, a lot of people, many men, women on the subject. It's a subject that I used to build out my PhD. My doctoral dissertation is on hamartiology and the church, an examination of porneia, which is another way of saying we're going to take a look at the sin within the church. And we're going to use sexual immorality as the shoehorn to access the problem that the church has with its understanding of sin. And because I used this subject, I have a really good understanding of it biblically. And it's been something that I've used to counsel and direct and lead and help a lot of folks along the way. So folks, if this is an area where you struggle, feel free to reach out to me. Call me. Let's set up a time. It'll be free. I don't charge, but I'm happy to help, okay? And now let's get started with adultery and dismemberment. This one may take a little longer than the usual 25, 30 minutes, but I want to make sure the content gets there. Now, the way we're going to roll this out is I'm going to kind of lay down some cones like I always do and set it up so that you can hear the words correctly, right? Once you get the right context, then you can hear it. And that's what I'm going to do. Okay, so let's talk first about horror films. What in the world? Yeah, I mean, the title of today's podcast, Adultery and Dismemberment, it should remind you a little bit of a horror film. I mean, cutting up a body into pieces is a common theme, as is adultery in scary movies, because the very act of cutting up a body is near the horizon of our horrific things that we can conjure with our imaginations. I mean, it leaves the viewer deeply disturbed. I mean, the head is not supposed to be separated from the body. And whenever you see the special effects going to work and it's really gruesome, we all cringe and pull back. And of course, the victims, well, there's no chance for them in these kinds of movies, right? And this is the point, right? The part is not supposed to be seen as completely distinct from the whole, right? The arm is not supposed to be detached and flailing around on the floor with blood spurting out of it. But it is in horror films. That dismemberment is shocking. Why? Because the part is not supposed to be distinct from the whole. And yes, we do this all the time, not just in horror films, right? Our critically thinking minds actually really enjoy breaking big things down into small things. Do you ever think about that? That the reasoning mind is always differentiating this between that, good and bad, right and wrong, up and down, you know, valid and invalid. What makes things tick? How do they work? This is all good as far as it goes. But the scientific mind separates things into smaller and smaller building blocks in order to kind of understand how they all work together, how they correlate. And it's this last step, correlation, that is absolutely vital. Because if you don't correlate all the building blocks, then we have the greatest miss, the greatest mistake, the greatest sin of all humanity. And let me just give you an example. I mean, it's great that there are photons and gluons. I'm sure some of you didn't even know there was such a thing as a gluon or photon, but those are subatomic particles which function in electrons, protons, and neutrons, right? The atoms, right? Which make the atoms, which in atoms comprised in different configurations make our molecules, right? Our periodic chart is made up of atomic energy, which becomes the building blocks of everything we know, right? So all the big things are really small things. However, if that photon is not correlated or integrated with a person's experience, then we never really know who we are. And we are not merely photons, right? I mean, some people would love to just break us down and say, you know, we're really just balls of energy. And that is true. That is so true. We are really just energetic fields, which the whole world of quantum physics changes everything and really has a powerful correlation with the space of religion and the space of spirituality. But that's not helpful, right? What's the value of a photon to a cat, right? Does my cat care about photons or atoms or the periodic chart? Absolutely not. And most people are not too far, they're much further along than a cat. Like, most of us don't care what a photon does either. It's not until you gain that correlation. You have to connect the whole to the part and the part to the whole. The universal and the particular have to go together, right? If the neurologist and the cardiologist don't communicate, then they're disintegrated. And then the diagnoses can conflict, right, with one another. We see this everywhere. And so this, folks, is the biggest problem. This is the problem that Jesus is actually unearthing in multiple places Like he's basically decoding the Ten Commandments. And several times he says, you heard that it said one thing, and he's reading the Ten Commandment. And then he says, but I say to you, here's the thing. And he gives true meaning to it by exposing the deeper problem. So on a more practical level, dismemberment really occurs everywhere. Every time you make a judgment about another person, we are actually taking the part and applying it to the whole, right? When that person cuts you off, you're like, that person is a total jerk. Really? Are they really a jerk? Or did you not see the sick baby in the back seat and they are trying desperately to get them to medical care? Are they a total jerk now? Well, see, now you have a little more of the story. You know, and the backstory is something we all possess, but none of us can see, especially from a distance. So when you're sitting there judging a person by what they wear, how they look, or whatever, you're actually taking that part and separating it from the whole. You're dismembering the person, which we know nothing about. We know nothing about the backstory. And see, we all have one, which is hidden. And we all have a persona, the thing that we put on in front, which is not hidden. That's how, when we get dressed, we're assembling our persona. We do our hair, our makeup, the way we look, the way we act, the way we talk, the way we speak. It's all part of our persona. And see, we begin tearing each other apart when we're young, and it really becomes the gravest of invisible sins because we grow immune by mere overexposure. Think about how often this happens and how little we are challenged to deal with it. Making two things out of one thing is the heart of division. It is the opposite direction of the flow of God, which makes one thing out of all things. And you see that, Hear, O Israel, in the Jewish Shema, the Lord thy God, the Lord is one. This is not just a monotheistic statement. This is a statement, a trajectory of how all things are converging into the oneness of God and union with God. This is the opposite, the absolute opposite of loving your neighbor as yourself. Do you ever think about that? Because we never separate the part from our whole story. So whenever we steal from the office supply cabinet, we have the backstory that says, well, you don't realize they totally docked me my pay on my commission. And my boss said I can just take it out of the supply cabinet over time if I need to. And so while the other person just saw you stealing and thinks you're a thief, you know the backstory and you gave yourself a pass. But that's what it means to love your neighbor as yourself, is wait for the backstory. Don't judge them, right? This is what it means to be loving. And you almost never see that, especially in religious communities. We don't wait for the backstory, right? We just judge. And because we never separate a part of our whole story from ourselves, we simply just don't dismember ourselves. That's the sin. Division, divorce, dismemberment. That's the deeper problem here. Okay, so now you are ready for today's verse from the Sermon on the Mount, okay? This is what it says. You've heard that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye causes you to stumble, just gouge it out and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into hell. And if your right hand causes you to stumble, cut it off and throw it away. It's better for you to lose one part of your body than for your whole body to go into hell. Okay, so if this is your first week, you're just tuning in and you're hearing me talk about hell, I want you to go back to last week's post where I decode what Jesus is talking about here. Hell is not the eternal destination. The church has used this verse in a horrible way, in an oppressive way, in an abusive way, okay? And that's because of their confusion over this. The hell, is, when it says throw it away, it's better than just throw it away. He's truly talking about throw it in the dump. And Gehenna is the city dump just south of Jerusalem, the Valley of Hinnom. And culturally, everybody would have known that they were talking about the dump. Now, this is also just a side note. Whenever you have somebody who says they believe the Bible, whenever you have somebody who says, I take the Bible, every word of it is literal, every word of it is the inspired word of God, then you ask that person, why do they still have their arm? And why do they still have both their eyes? because I guarantee you throughout their life, their eye has caused them to stumble. Their hand has caused them to stumble. Why did they not take this passage literally and amputate themselves? Well, the answer is clear. This is not intended to be taken literally. Jesus is not saying, cut off your hand. He's saying, do something drastic. We're going to get into that, okay? Now, think about this for a minute, folks. This verse is the biggest bludgeoning tool women in the church have had to use against their men. Lust is typically more a man's problem than it is a woman's problem. See, women typically struggle with worry, and we're going to get to that later in the chapter, in chapter 6. But this verse about lust, when Jesus says, if you look at a woman, if you blepo, if you go on looking, continue looking at a woman with lust in your heart, with lustful intent, then you have already committed adultery with her in her heart. Women, especially women in the church, have used this to say, I don't want to be married to an adulterer, and I will not tolerate even the slightest little indiscretion from my husband. And if I found him looking at porn, if I see him looking at other women, then I feel like he has committed adultery against me, and, you know, they can't get over it. Women really love this. It really empowers them because this isn't usually their thing. Lusting is usually not a woman's thing. It can be, but typically it's a guy's vice. Now, this has been used to punish husbands, fiancés, boyfriends by making physical attraction synonymous with lust, which is synonymous with adultery. So if you are attracted to anybody but your wife, you are an adulterer, becomes the message. And don't think for a second that is not how it plays out. It is exactly how it plays out. And playing this card in the church is a very convenient way to have manhood, all of mankind, most men, kowtow to the insecurities of women. And so there's been this kind of, forgive the term, but chickification of the church over the years. More and more women have neutered their men. They have said that aspect of your manhood is sinful, and if you love Jesus, you'll eradicate it. You'll cut it out from your life, right? And so men go around with these double lives, convincing their wives that she's the only woman he's ever been attracted to, and, you know, saying all these things about how he never, ever has any kind of attraction to another person. And they try and believe them as much as they can. It's a whole dance of deception, which is really not true. And it really is just a way for men to bow to the insecurities of women who are constantly feeling insecure about their bodies. Why? Because we live in a very over-sexualized world and because of some of these other dynamics, not the women's fault. Now, my doctoral dissertation proved here that pornography is not a sin because it shows too much. This is the quagmire that the church and other religious organizations, and often many times just people trying to live a decent standard, fall into. They think that nudity becomes pornography, right? We don't want to see two people having sex. That's pornography. Really? What if it's a documentary about sexual intercourse, about, you know, conception or something else? Does that make it pornography? What about art? You know, what if there's nudity in art, in Renaissance art? Is that pornography? Well, some used to say it was. Some still say it is. Some say that Victoria's Secret catalog, which is an underwear company, is pornography. What is pornography, right? And everybody thinks it's this external commodity that you consume. And it's not, right? It's not the problem. It all gets into this problem of where do you draw the line, because they think pornography is a sin because it's showing us too much. There's too much visibility. There's too much of the woman's body. Folks, hear me now. What I proved in my doctoral dissertation and what is true about what Jesus is saying here is that pornography or lust is not a sin because it shows too much. It is a sin because it shows way too little. Right? You're not seeing enough. You see, this is why I had to do the whole front end on dismemberment. You've cut off the whole person. And you're seeing just the part, not the whole person. You see, religion has created this arbitrary line of morality where nudity becomes equivalent to pornography. And so, like, a woman in a bikini is acceptable, but a woman without a bikini, and you can see that pigment change on her areola, that somehow makes it abhorrent to God and country. You know, let's not forget, Adam and Eve were created naked, and they were created to enjoy the way they looked, and I'm sure Adam and Eve did. Right? It wasn't until shame kicked in that they put the leaves over themselves. And so here comes the church with that fig leaf is just not big enough, right? More shame, more guilt, more oppression about who we are. It's not right. So the result is this demonizing of the female form. And then they demonize the man for liking it. You see, some religions, especially in Islam, they go so far as to make women entirely responsible for causing men to lust. And the solution is to just obscure them completely from head to toe. Like a burqa, full thing. And I know there are other reasons, but the main reason is that a woman who chooses not to wear a burqa, who leaves her hair out, who shows her legs, who shows her midriff or her arms, is now viewed in that culture as a total adulteress or a loose woman or somebody who they should despise. Is that true? Why should a woman be responsible for what's going on in a man's mind? This is Jesus' whole contention. So the Me Too movement should get behind Jesus here, right? Now, a common thing in Jesus' teaching surrounds this sin of dividing things, which is the result of binary thinking. Right? His counsel on lust is that it's better to dismember yourself than to dismember another, which is really his way of rephrasing the golden rule. Like, look, if you're going to just dismember people, then just dismember yourself too, right? Because you're not going to find yourself living in the kingdom of God, out from this place of love, not from the place of reframing everything into a new way, right? That's the kingdom that Jesus comes and is talking about and revealing through the sermon. You're not gonna live from that place if you're constantly dismembering other people. So just dismember yourself and get it over with. Throw it in the fire, right? The whole framework is failed from the beginning. Anyone who divides another, including themselves, is not living from the kingdom, but holistically living from a personal hell. You see, of course, eye gouging and arm amputating is not to be a literal interpretation or a solution. You could cut off your arm and then discover that your lust returned. This would make you assume that blind people never have lust or issues. They do. And fortunately, even the most fundamental believers don't take this passage literally, which is always a great passage to point out when they argue that the Bible needs to be taken literally whenever it's convenient for them. Jesus clearly is not intending that. What he is, he's obviously saying that we have to pay attention to our inner motives. And just like name-calling is the seed that grows to murder, which we saw last week, so giving vent to attraction and allowing it to go to lust is the seed of adultery. The point is that we have to take a drastic measure. Cutting off your arm, gouging out your eye, the idea is that you do something drastic to prevent the normal biological reality from growing into the ruin of oneself and others. See, we have to manage the small thing, knowing that it is but a small version of the big thing. But folks, let me just make it very clear. He is saying it is not the same as the big thing. It is not the big thing. See, lust may be adultery within the heart, just as name-calling is murder within the heart. But lust is not the same as adultery in like manner. They cannot be the same thing. They are within the heart because they're different aspects of the same seed. One is the blossom and one is the seed. And this teaching only makes sense when we free ourselves from a binary framework. And this whole sermon is really about getting us out of this place. You see, if you look at this passage from a binary framework, which most people do, and this is why it becomes an abusive, oppressive passage, which is a living hell for everybody who follows and believes it that way, we lock ourselves into either one side of the story when it's not really black and white, despite most people believing that lust is either the same as adultery or it's not. right? So if you don't believe that lust is the same as adultery, then you feel free to lust, and therefore you'd be looked down upon by somebody who takes their faith very seriously. And if you saw lust as the same as adultery, then you'd want to treat it the same. And then, of course, you'd have this high accountability, and, you know, your wife is injured and hurt and offended every time, you know, somebody prettier than them walks by. See, this teaching is actually saying that lust is the essence of adultery, but not in full bloom. You see, a sunflower seed is not a sunflower, but the sunflower is somehow contained in the seed. And given the right environment and time, it's going to come out. So if you want to end murder and you want to end adultery, just stop it at the headwaters. That's the point, right? So Jesus really brings true meaning to the commandment by, once again, driving it to the heart level. You know, we have to become self-aware. You guys, I'm always talking about raising your consciousness, becoming self-aware. These are the deeper spiritual practices of anybody who's doing soul care, who's on a journey, walking, following, pursuing, hoping to find God. Right? Pay close attention to the motivations within your heart. You see, if we lose sight of what is happening inside us, we ultimately just lose our true self. Our appetites take us off the rails every time. And Jesus is simply admonishing us to do something drastic about the small, unnoticeable part, so that the word here, holon, the whole part of the soma, the body, isn't lost, right? Do something about that small, invisible part within, so that the whole part, the self, the whole self, isn't lost. This is the meaning of Gehenna again. It's the description of a dump where things are, it says, bale hapo, thrown out, thrown into the trash. This is the living hell. Now, what this is not saying, and I am going to uncoach you from years and years of horrible preaching and teaching right now, okay? Tune in, turn it up your radio. This passage is not saying that if you have lust in your heart, you are going to hell when you die. It is not saying lust in your heart will send you to hell. It's saying our unwillingness to manage our motivation, to manage the headwaters, our inability to see the small thing, to carve it out, to see this, if we carve out the small thing from the whole thing, if we can't manage our motivations, it means we are already in hell. It means we're already there. So trying to convince your spouse, a church, or others that these impulses within you are only in the past tense, back when I was a sinner, but Jesus saved me, I'm delivered, I used to really look at that kind of pornography or whatever, but now I never do, or I never have, and it's never part of my life anymore. This is a big deception that far too many of us really prefer. I mean, we love to roll this tape in men's groups and church and potlucks and everything else, women talking at tables and everything. Oh, my husband would never do that, blah, blah, blah. Right? We prefer the deception to the truth of really what lies within us. And that's the whole point. Well, why don't we look deeper at what's really in you? You're going to be surprised to discover that the seed of every horrible sin lies dormant within you. There's not one that you miss, and same with me. And what could be more of a living hell than knowing that about yourself and having this double life or an inner struggle, but pretending on the outside that it doesn't exist? And yet that's what we do, week after week, parading around as if we were better than that. Folks, this is a living hell. And we are not punished one day for our sins. This is not saying that. This is not threatening that. What it's saying is we are punished today by our sins. Do you hear that distinction? You're not punished one day for your sin. You're punished today by them. You see, your life today is simply the blossom on your previous seeds of thinking. And so Jesus' sermon offers freedom from this trap by no longer divorcing our humanity from our spirituality. They are one and the same. If you change today, if you relearn how to think today, your life will move into conformity to the heaven within. And you don't have to worry about what happens when you die. if you can't change how you think right now, if you can't do something drastic about the small part, then you're already in hell. So don't worry about your heaven. Stop believing your religious mind and your practice and your beliefs is somehow going to take you someplace where you can't even be right now. That tells you that your faith has no power. Your faith is dead. And I know that's sobering. And I know that sounds harsh. But folks, I love you enough to tell you, change today and life will move into conformity to the heaven within. And then you'll never have to worry about it again. See, liberation from lust, folks, is not going to come through a computer nanny that keeps nipples from appearing from our screen. And if, let me just say that. If you're struggling with this and you went to your pastor and he put you on Every Man's Battle and they had your wife install Covenant Eyes onto your computer and there's this accountability group that whenever you a nipple pops on your screen, somebody else got to see it and has to get a report of the websites you visited, that is not how you deal with this problem. You can't do it from the outside in. This is not a behavior modification program. That's what religion does. This is inner transformation. That's what the gospel does. See, it's not going to come from a religion or a spouse that emasculates you. You know, it's not going to come from you losing this aspect of your manhood, of attraction. This is part of your sexual reality. Own it, but don't give vent to it, right? Don't think you have to become like a woman who doesn't usually think like that. I'm not saying to those women that you don't, because I know some of you do, but typically this is a man's burden. Don't stop being a man. See, it's not going to come from that. It's not going to come from your fear of eternal torment. Stop throwing yourself down and every time you fall on your face and saying how much you suck and how horrible you are and what a great sinner you are. All that does is cause you to jump deeper into shampoo Christianity, which has rewrote the script on you begging and begging and begging over and over again for the mercy of God to forgive you for your sins. And that's only as good until the next time you fall on your face. And then you just keep doing it and doing it and doing it. Don't you want to get off of that Ferris wheel, that terrible circus ride? There is a way to live from heaven by not fearing whether or not you're going to get there. Okay, it's not going to come from the fear of eternal torment or some elaborate theology that titillates your intellect instead of titillating your body, right? You can move away from your body and move into some kind of a theological mental masturbation. And trust me, you're not any healthier. You've simply gone from one addiction to another. Right, liberation from lust is a spiritual practice of loving the whole person, not a punitive religious transaction. If you want liberation from lust, it requires eyes that see not just parts, eyes that learn to see the whole picture. This isn't going to come overnight. You didn't learn to just objectify a woman or objectify a man in one day. This has been part of your gradual training for years and years, and it's worked its way into your own sexual response cycle. And so now you can't see the whole from the part. Now that's what lust and healing from lust is going to do. If you can do that, adultery is the blossom that will never take place. And lust, just like murder, is the sin of separating and dismembering. Healing then is the practice of reintegrating all the pieces that are invisible until we pause long enough to awaken to them. So, healing is the loving practice of seeing beyond everything.